obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And when you get old, you have to sit down sometimes, so it's... Actually, I like it. It feels less formal. I feel like I'm just visiting here with all of you, and I like that. I really enjoy coming to Los Angeles. I just feel like I am received so warmly, and over the years have gotten so many friends out here that it's something that I really look forward to, and it really... really hurt me to have to cancel due to my illnesses. So I'm so happy that it all worked out tonight and I get to share with you all. Before I get started, there's a lot of people in the room I want to thank. And some of you may not know, but last year my youngest daughter was murdered and my oldest daughter died 3 months later of alcoholism. And it was a big blow, and I can talk a little bit about how to get through that. But in my living room back in Tampa, I overlooked Tampa Bay, and I have a window there, and in front of the window I have an old trunk. And on top of the trunk are the two memorials to my daughters. And they consist of two baskets. And each basket is filled with cards and letters. And on top of that is the memorial service with the photograph, etc. And there's somewhere in the vicinity of 600 letters and cards that came in from AA people from all over. And a lot of them came from L.A., and I know there's people in this room that were kind enough to share their thoughts. Some of them were from individuals, some of them were for groups, from groups. I remember an Al-Anon group in Alaska. Everybody in the group signed it and sent it down. And when my other children visit, they go over and look at it. And they're overcome because they know AA, they grew up with AA, but they just see this. And you just, all you have to do is kind of look at it and see the impact. And so that'll be there forever. And I know whoever you are here that sent some of those cards in, I want to thank you, and my family wants to thank you. I have one daughter left who's in AA. My youngest daughter had 5 years in AA. And I was, boy, it was a lucky thing because they're all spread out around the country. We don't get to see each other that often. But she was the chairman of the New Haven, Connecticut AA conference. And I was one of the speakers, and her sister introduced me. And so that was one of those unbelievable memories that happened the year before last. So I just want to share all that. And then I do want to say two quick lessons that I got out of that. Because these events happened to us, and I hope you remember this one, that when you receive news of something, there is a moment before you react to it. You generally look for a place to sit down and to collect your breath. But there is definitely a period of time before you let it sink in. And if you will take that moment and turn to God, your higher power, and say to him, I just want you to know ahead of time, this is not going to change how I feel about you. You come ahead of everything. And I just want you to know that you're the most important relationship in my life. Then turn and go back and sit down. And guess who comes with you? And you have a source that is just carries you. And the only things I had to deal with was sorrow. I didn't have to deal with anger, resentment, any of those things. So I just offer that as a gift to, because it came to me, somebody else showed me that. So I'm getting that out of the way in the beginning. I hate to start off a talk with such heavy stuff, but it's wonderful what AA did for my family during last year, and I want to thank everybody. Now let's see, it's customary to talk a little bit about our stories and how we got sober and all those things, so I'll try to follow that format a little bit. I like to mostly talk about AA and things I've learned in here and the teachers that I've had, but I will say that I'm gonna be 80 in September. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. I have one sister, she's got 33 years in AA, and she's just a delight. Like a lot of alcoholics when we were little, I felt like I didn't belong. Holy cow, felt like I didn't belong. I haven't met anybody yet who didn't feel like they belonged. That's our specialty. And so you spend time alone thinking about why you don't belong and what's wrong with the world and why you're screwed up. And in the meantime, you pretend that you're happy so nobody will bug you. And my experience with church was the exact opposite of my sister. She went to church every Sunday and loved it. She still goes. It was great comfort to her. To me, sitting next to her, it was just the opposite. The nuns looked like little Gestapo agents, and the incense and Latin. I didn't know what the heck they were talking about. They were probably plotting something against me up there, and blah, blah, blah. Confession, I remember that church. It was scary just to go back. It was all dark, and there's just this. I felt creepy going in, and I knew they were gathering evidence to use against me later. So I took no comfort in any of this. Why didn't I take any comfort? Because my perception of it was wrong. That's not what was going on. But when your perception is wrong, that's your reality. And then you have to emotionally react to that reality. So I was very uncomfortable in there, while my sister is just so happy and pleased to be there. So you can see it's very important that we have help in our perception of things, which is why we run things by each other. It's an essential part of spirituality, of just getting through life, is to never try to assess a situation by yourself. It just leads to faulty perception, is generally what it is. Anyway, I didn't know anything about this. I just went around being uncomfortable and worried about things. But I had fun at the same time, and the big event in my life was World War II. All my relatives were in it. I was, I was 10 when it started and 15 when it ended. And so it kind of consumed everything as far as we were concerned. And we were on the East Coast, so we had the submarines and we had blackouts, and my mother was the air raid watcher. She was up on a hill and reporting in every airplane that went by. We threw pots and pans in the center of town. She would find another pot that she could get along without and take it in and throw it in the chicken wire fence, and they'd melt them down for bullets. And blackout on the curtains and the headlights on the cars just shone down on the street, and everything was rationed. But everybody was in it. You didn't hear a lot of complaining because we were all in the same game. We were all united against a common enemy. It's very similar to AA. The reason we get along so well, all of us individuals, we never behaved ourselves anywhere, and we come into AA and something inside of us said, I think I'll behave myself in here because my life is on the line. You almost don't have to teach unity. It doesn't take very long where you suddenly realize, I'm just going to go along here And so I think the whole country was going along. So it was a much more united feeling. And then once it's over and mass production, and pretty soon everybody has a house, everybody has a car, the GIs are all going, oh, now we got money in our pockets. To hell with everybody else. I got my car, I got my house. And so we sort of have that when things are going well, we don't stay as unified. And so that's why AA is so wonderful, because this common enemy isn't going anywhere. It's going to be out there. It's walking around this meeting right now looking for somebody who says, I'm tired of AA. Hey, come on over. I'll buy you a drink. And then it's just because somebody's just not willing to try the plan that we have here. So alcohol gets a hold of them and works on them a year or two, and then willingness shows up. It's not an intellectual acquisition. It is a pain-inspired acquisition, willingness. So anyway, I was a pretty good little student and athlete, and I went to a little prep school and fed right into Yale University in New Haven. I had worked on their buildings. I did a lot of construction. But when I got there, I suddenly was with a lot of important people. And these guys were kind of wealthy, and they knew what was going on. I'd seen some of them in the newspapers, and I suddenly realized, I'm in the wrong place. I don't belong with these people. And I just wanted to get out of there. It was very awkward. And I hadn't started drinking because I was trying to get good grades and be on an athletic team. But I was at a social event one night, and I was supposed to meet these other 20 people, and I couldn't even stick my hand out because I could see from looking at them that they didn't want to know me. It was very easy. They just took a look and went, you forget it. We don't want to know you. So I walked around from group to group, and I was getting ready to do what I always do, which is to leave. Whenever you're anxious, you leave, and the anxiety goes away. It's a very simple process. And that night I decided, well, maybe I'll try one of these drinks, because they had a little bar there. So I went up to the bartender and ordered something. It didn't taste particularly good, but I had been assured that alcohol makes you feel great by my roommates. So I had one, I had two, and I was starting in on the third, and I didn't feel any different at all. And I actually think I was getting ready to leave. And I looked out at the people in the room, and they all wanted to know me. And I said, well, God, I can't leave now. They all want to know me. And so I decided to go introduce myself to everyone. And as I went over to each group, I suddenly realized they were right. They would be lucky to know me. And, of course, it was like I was let out of the box. I could be myself for the first time in my life. The anxiety was gone, my creativity. I was funny. And I'm just talking and talking and talking. Pretty soon they're leaving. And I'm going, where are you guys going? They said, well, we have to study. We got to say, oh, no, we're just getting to know each other. This is the guy who was the Lone Ranger, doesn't want people to go home. They left, and I remember saying to myself, God, three drinks. I wonder what 20 would do. I mean, that's just astounding. So on that one evening, I got the whole deal with alcohol, and I drank as much as I could drink and went back and got sick all night. And sat on the bed the next morning thinking I was very near death after puking all night and the splitting headache. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again tonight? And I went, yes. There was no hesitation. I just said, this puking and dying is a small price to pay for what I had last night. So that's why I'm an alcoholic. Because the experience that I had from drinking alcohol was beyond belief. It was so spectacular, so special, so spiritual-like that it was worth anything to have it. Non-alcoholics don't have that. They go, well, how's drink? Oh, it's pretty good. Oh, it's not beyond belief? No, it's pretty good. Well, it's hard to puke and die for pretty good. But for beyond belief, we'll pay any price. And so I was getting introduced to this. It was all laid out right in front of me. And I had made a decision that drinking was going to be way up at the top of the list. And that as long as drinking was around, life would be terrific. So the grades went, the athletics went, I started getting in fights, started getting arrested, but I was having fun. Man, I was having fun. I got more drink stories from there, but it would just take too long. But that was amazing. The Korean draft was still on, so we had to join some branch of the military, and six of us were drinking beer, and one of them said, "Let's join the Marines." And I went, "Okay, yeah, come on." And then I finished the beer and go down, and then the recruiter is just going like this when we came walking, and he signed up all six of us. And of course, those of you that join the military, you know when you get there, it's like, "Are you kidding?" I saw a brochure with a golf course. The hell is this? So that was exciting. And the Marines are, I just loved it. I ended up falling in love with the Marine Corps and became a regular officer and was making a career. And so I finished the 6-month infantry training. I saw a training movie about pilots, and they looked like they were having one hell of a time. They weren't sleeping outside. They were in a hotel or something, and there was blondes walking around, and they were talking with their hands, and I just, something said, "I think I'll see what those guys are up to." So I asked this major, I said, "I think I'd like to become a pilot." I had never been in an airplane. And he said, "Well, you don't want to do that. You have to sign up for 3 more years. I said, "That's, I'm not doing anything. I didn't have a clue what I wanted to be when I grow up. I still don't." And so I signed up and I passed the flight physical. I had met this wonderful woman from Madison, Connecticut, who ended up being the mother of all 6 children. And we got married, went down to New York on the train, spent a few days, and then we're off to Pensacola, Florida, flight school, got on an airplane, got airsick, flying down, got airsick. Going from Atlanta to Pensacola, got airsick in the first 5 flights in the old SNJ. But the motion sickness went away, and all of a sudden, I am just having a blast. I'm finishing number 2 or 3 all the way through, you know, formation and gunnery and going aboard the carrier and all that stuff. And so 18 months later in Corpus Christi, Texas, I get my wings. I go come to El Toro. And I was out at El Toro when Disneyland opened. Was I telling you that, Steve? Yeah, and I was with another guy, another lieutenant, and we were drinking a beer, and we said, "What the hell is Disneyland?" We just heard about it. They had just mowed down all the orange groves over there and put something in. And he said, "Oh, it's great. They have a castle, and Mickey Mouse is there, and he shakes your hand when you come in." And I went, "What? Mickey Mouse?" I said, "Let's go over and look at that." So we went over, and it just opened, and the parking lot was a gigantic, from what I remember, but it was only a third full. And we rode on in, and there was Mickey, and there's a castle, and there was some stuff. And I asked somebody, I said, "Where can you get a drink around here?" And they said, "Oh, no, you can't have a drink." So we left. That was all, you know, and I said, got back in the car and I said, "They think they're going to fill this parking lot up?" I mean, I remember, I think you could have given me Disney stock and I would have said, "No, that's going to go bankrupt. So don't rely on me to judge your business ventures," because the two of us thought it was the silliest thing we ever saw. Anyway, we had a training there for about 6 months and then we went overseas. The war is over. I'm in a fighter squadron with wonderful people, and I'm over there for 14 months and just had, it was just, the flying was wonderful, the drinking was wonderful, the colonel, we all drank together, and it was the one time that I remember being with a group of guys so that we're at a table and they're ordering drinks and I didn't have to sneak up to the bar to get an extra one. You remember how when you were with a crowd, nobody drinks as fast as we do. So you'd rather go to the bathroom, and then you'd go by the bar, "Give me a double scotch on the rock," and then you'd drink that, and then come back to the table. "Yeah, I'll have another one." "Okay." And they don't know we're drinking quite well. I didn't have to do that. The whole crowd was right up at my level, and I just felt like I was in hog heaven. Now, in spite of being in the middle of that, there was a time after about 8 or 9 months that I was talking with this major who was going to get his own fighter squadron. He pointed at me, wanted me to be in his squadron. I felt really good. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I remember saying to myself, I pretend I didn't hear it. That's what I did. I mean, that was like, I don't want to hear that. I'm not going to ask him why. And it wasn't until I got to AA that I realized my drinking in a group of heavy drinkers frightened them. In other words, they were just getting drunk a lot. They weren't quite sure what I was doing. But it was more than that. There was an intensity to it. If I had the flu, I still showed up and drank more than anybody else. In other words, there's traits that we have that were coming out in the very beginning, but I never noticed them. I thought I was the same as everybody else. And I got a lot of good tours of duty after that. I was with the 1st Marine Division at Pendleton, and then I was a flight instructor back in Pensacola, and then I was in a photo squadron during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I had decided to be a career officer. I made it to captain. But if you don't make it to major, when the promotion zones come up, you have to leave. And that's what happened to me. I finally got to the end of the line and I was forced out. But before I got there, I had come to the end of flying. I started flying, especially the last year at Cherry Point, flying the Crusader. It was a hard airplane to fly, and I was having withdrawal symptoms because I was not drinking for 8 hours prior to getting in the plane, and when you're getting at the last stages of alcoholism, you're going through a withdrawal. It would be better to have a drink than to go through withdrawal while you're flying. And so it was terrifying me because I would lose vision, I would feel like I'm passing out, my hands were trembling, and I'm sure my heart was just pounding. And I would fly with one hand on the ejection seat, and you could fly with the mission, all the cameras are on the stick. And I knew nothing about AA, the Navy had no alcohol programs. I just said, I'm stuck with this. I'm going to somehow have to survive this. So I just kept drinking and getting in airplanes. Then it went on for about 6 months. And on a cross country in a different airplane with 4 other airplanes, I decided that I had to get out of the plane, that I couldn't take it anymore. I felt like I was going to have a seizure. And I remember thinking how you got out of this plane. It didn't have an ejection seat. The panel opened and you slid out the bottom. And I was looking at it and I realized that there's another guy in the plane, a radar observer, and he doesn't know how to fly. He has no idea I'm sitting over there thinking of leaving. So I declared an oxygen emergency, and when you do that, the flight leader has to find... Oh, thanks. The flight leader has to find a place to land immediately because if the oxygen was bad, both people could pass out. So he picked an Air Force base nearby. We landed, and I went to the club and got a couple drinks. I felt a little bit better, but then the next morning when we went down, the maintenance people said there was nothing wrong with the oxygen. I took a look at the plane, and I turned to the flight leader, and I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. Now, this was my favorite thing. This was my whole life. And my alcoholism said, you aren't going to do this anymore. You're either going to fly or you're going to drink. So I told the flight leader, I'm not going to do this anymore. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm not going to do it anymore. He said, okay. So somebody else flew us back. And then I had to see the colonel. He said, Sandy, what are you talking about? I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. I'm not going to discuss it. And I just looked at the floor and told him I wasn't going to discuss it. And so he said, well, if you insist on that, then we're going to have to contact Headquarters Marine Corps, take you off flight status, and you're going to have to be retrained in something else. I said, fine. That was a terrible moment to have to face. And for 3 months, I did the legal work in that squadron. I did the special court martials, and I stayed in a little office, and I would not make eye contact with any of the pilots because I knew they were so disgusted with having a piece of junk like me in their midst. And I felt nothing but shame, and at the end of 3 months, I was transferred and went on and got retrained and did that for a couple of years, and then the whole thing blew up, and I ended up in a nut ward and eventually got to AA, and then the Marine Corps got rid of me. And a lot of you people, since you're from out here, you know what happened 3 years ago. I'm at the Brentwood Group, and Linda from Santa Barbara is getting her 30-year medallion. Her husband Jim is driving her, and he's not an AA member, but he comes around AA all the time. And she said, "We have a leader tonight, Sandy B." She said, "Is he a pilot?" And she said, "Yeah." He said, "I think I know him. Tell him to come out here." So I went outside, and I never saw this guy. And he looked at me, and he said, "In 1962, you were in a flight of 4 F-3Ds on a cross country. You declared an oxygen emergency, and and all the planes landed, and you never flew again." And I went, "How the hell do you know that?" And he said, "I was in the plane with you." And what are the odds 42 years later that I'm going to run into the guy that was over here? Turns out it wasn't a radar guy. He was an American airline pilot that had been recalled for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we had flown the planes out of Cherry Point because a hurricane was coming. The pilots are so brave. When a hurricane comes to the base, the pilots fly the planes to safety and drink until the hurricane goes away. Everyone else stays there and faces the hurricane. So we had been off partying until it was over. And so he came up to Oxnard the next day and brought photographs from the squadron. And I went, "Oh, yeah, and I remember this," because I had blocked it all out. And then he said, "Did you know how popular you were in that squadron?" He said, "It broke our hearts that you were leaving." He said the colonel tried everything he could do. He even called some congressman, but there was no alcohol program. He said, "When you finally left, we were almost in tears." And I said to myself, "That's not how I remember it." So I had to go back 42 years and change the past. I had to substitute my perception of what was going on with the truth. And I submit to you that a great deal of spiritual sobriety consists in doing exactly that, which is getting rid of old ideas and replacing them with the truth as it is revealed to us. And that's why the world becomes a better place. Our families become better families. It's just a miracle. And it was just the most powerful thing to suddenly have 3 months of shame gone permanently. Every time I think back on it now, I go, wasn't I lucky to be with all those people that liked me so much? It's a whole different memory. And it all came about just by coincidence. Anyway, I ended up, as I told you, in a I had a grand mal seizure at a school, career school, and was sent up to Bethesda Nut Ward, the Bethesda Naval Hospital Mental Ward. And while I was in there, I had the delirium tremens, and I was in a straitjacket, and I was there for 6 months. And some AA people talked the head psychiatrist into letting them bring a meeting in. They had nothing for alcoholics. In other words, you couldn't be diagnosed as an alcoholic. You had to have some mental problem. But they talked their way in, and so that's how I got to AA. The corpsman came into the nut ward and said, "All drunks fall in." There were three of us, and we had our little blue bathrobe on. And we went down the elevator and went in, and these two guys told their stories. And you know, when they tell their story, you connect. They weren't giving a lecture on alcoholism. They were telling their story. And I just listened and listened. And I totally saw how wonderful it was, but my pride and arrogance stayed in the way, and all I said to him was, I'd like your phone number in case I run into a guy who needs the program. I'll send him around to see you. And one of the redheaded guys poked his finger in my chest, and he said, let me ask you something. He says, which one of us is going to put his coat on, go out, get in his car, and drive home to his family? And which one of us is going to take his little blue bathrobe and go upstairs and get locked up like an animal? Which one are you? And I remember going, man, these guys are rude. You know, they just, I just met him, and he's talking like that. So there eventually came a time when I was released as an outpatient so I could go home to my home down in Quantico, Virginia, the Quantico base, and commute back to the nut ward. Go home at night and then be home on weekends. And on one of the weekends, I remember saying, geez, the Redskins are playing. And I have a rule that you can't watch the Redskins unless you're drinking beer. So I guess I'll have to leave the set off. Or maybe.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
They told me if I ever drank again, I would be thrown out of the Marine Corps, but I think what they meant was if I ever get drunk again, they're going to throw me out of the Marine Corps. So I drank a beer and watched the Redskin game, and nothing happened. I went to bed. I didn't have another drink. The first drink didn't get me drunk. I went back to the nut ward, and all week, I celebrated in my mind being a former alcoholic. I drank the beer, and nothing happened. I drank the beer, and nothing happened. I drank the beer, and nothing happened. I couldn't eat. I could hardly sleep. I was so excited being free from alcohol. So, had a one-week obsession with alcohol and called it freedom. So on the way home the next week, I really preferred vodka. And I remember going, well, there's another Redskin game on. And I went into the package store, and I swear, if you had put a lie detector on my wrist, I went in and I told myself I'm getting a year's supply, a quart. I would have passed the test. Because in my mind, I was going to have one every time there was a football game. Well, that bottle ran out before the weekend ran out. And I had to smuggle it, alcohol back in the nut ward. I knew they were going to catch me. So I called AA on Pearl Harbor Day of 1964. They sent a guy over to my house. That's back when you didn't go to meetings. They came to your house. You didn't have to pick a sponsor either. That was the guy. It was piece of cake. And he came in and he explained AA to your family, so they understood everything. And then he came over and I didn't want to talk to him. My family was squealing on me. I had changed my mind. I actually called the intergroup and said, I feel better. Tell him not to come. He says, too late. He's on his way. He was a very persuasive man. And when he got through talking to my family, it was about 7 at night and there was a meeting in Manassas at 7:30. He came out and I was shooting baskets outside. And he came out and he said, hey, get in the car. And I said, why? He said, we're going to a meeting. So I got in the car. I went to the meeting. It was a group anniversary. That meeting lasted almost 5 hours. They had anniversaries. They had speakers. They had a square dance with fiddles. And when I got to the meeting, I'm sober like 4 hours. Now I'm sober 9 hours. And I'm dying. I don't want to be at that meeting. And isn't sobriety wonderful? No, it sucks. But it was out in the wilderness in Manassas. There was no place to run to. There wasn't even a freaking street light. I was standing on the front porch of this stinky old Oddfellows Hall, figuring out how to make a break for it. And an Al-Anon lady came up named Betsy Lynch, and she put her hand on my shoulder, and I turned around, and I swear it was like an angel was touching me. And she said, come on back in, everything's going to be fine, and I believed her. I just walked back in. I never fought anything about the program since. And my sponsor was another Marine captain. We bonded, and we were together for 42 years. He was my sponsor. He passed away about 3 or 4 years ago. And right before he passed away, I went up to see him. He had emphysema. I think you remember the old days. Boy, he smoked everywhere, and I think more people died of smoking than alcohol sometimes. And we went to the Manassas group, the one he took me to. And I was speaking, and he was out there, and he had the oxygen and everything. And some of the people that had been there were still there. And we got through, and we went down, and we knew we probably wouldn't see each other again. And we just sat there and talked about how lucky we were to have those 42 years. It was the most precious gift. And the next time I saw his family was at the memorial service. And memorial services, I know we just had one here for Casey. I came out for Scott Redmond's. Memorial services in AA have to be the most inspiring event. They just celebrate the person's life, and his was no exception. It was such a, it's sad, but it was wonderful. It was wonderful because everyone there had received the good news. And if you're new, that's what AA is. This is the good news that you've been waiting for all your life. And everybody at this memorial service had received the good news, some of them from him, and we were celebrating the wonderful power that put all this together, that enabled us to connect with each other on an entirely different level. And that's what I love about AA, is that we just eliminate all the small talk and we get right to, what's going on? Well, come here, we're going to help you with that. We're going to, and people stick their nose in your business and they want to know why you're sad, and then they drag it out of you. Well, you got to forgive that person. I don't want to forgive him. You forgive me. And the next day they're happy and they announce how they thought up forgiving the person. And of course, that happens all the time. And so my life began here in AA, the real life. Prior to AA, we had to take the prodigal son and the prodigal daughter journey. That's how it works. You gotta go down. Your theme, you win by surrendering. Am I quoting it right? Win by surrendering? Surrender to win. Captures the whole essence of what holds AA together. The human ego does not surrender unless it's in a great deal of pain. It just doesn't happen. William James in The Varieties of Religious Experience talks all about that. All of these transformations that were recorded throughout history that he researched, where people suddenly were transformed into a positive person, had an awareness of the universe and their creator, all of them without exception happened to people who were desperate. They're absolutely desperate in their own lives. They found themselves looking at the black hole and were starting to lose hope. And that's what we all have in common, is that time came in our lives when it became unbearable, the thinking that we were doing and the life that we were leading. And that's when we could be approached to follow something as revolutionary as allowing someone else to make decisions about your life for you. That's the last thing human beings want to give up. The first line, the 12 and 12, who cares to admit complete defeat? Nobody. And we only do it because the pain is so great. I just am I'm so glad I went through the nut ward and the and all that horrible stuff, so that when they said, we want you to follow this path, even though you don't believe in it. And I remember looking at the steps. They said, everything you need is right in the steps. And I'm going, oh, yeah? I don't see it. Did anybody here get it when you read the steps? Oh, yeah, there they are on the wall. That makes sense to me. Yeah, sure. I see that. Yeah. I looked at it and went, what? What are you talking about? Where's the money step? I need money. I need money. You know, I had six kids, and I'm getting thrown out of the Marine Corps, and, you know, I'm broke. I mean, this is serious business, and you're going, well, I'm going to make little amends, and we're going to do a little inventory, and we're going to find a higher power. I said, yeah, so I don't need that. But there was nowhere else to go, and something crushed me enough so that I said, okay. I took out the white handkerchief and surrendered. And you know, when you think of that slogan, surrender to win, if you're going to stay a winner, you have to stay surrendered. It's easy to take it back. It's easy to suddenly realize and have the impression that you're a much stronger person now than you were 20 years ago when you sniveled in here. Because it feels like that. Yeah, I'm much stronger now. I'm so grateful to God. I remember the ego prayer. You don't want to trust a prayer that your ego thinks up. This is very dangerous. That ego said, come on, let's get on our knees and thank God. Really? You want to thank? Oh, yes, I want to thank God. I want to thank. Really? The ego wants, God, I want to thank you for bringing me in here, a hopeless, rotten person. Nobody. Now my family loves me. People respect me. I feel good about myself. God, I'm so grateful to you for placing me in a position where I no longer need your sorry butt. That's the ego prayer. Thank you for restoring me to self-sufficiency. And we are about ready to have a big event in our lives. And sometimes when we're new, you may not know why alcoholism is a fatal disease. Now I'm off on whatever comes into my head. So let me give you my shot on why alcoholism is a fatal disease. Why does it keep killing people? I'm not talking about people on Skid Row who never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, who never went to treatment and don't even know what's happening to them. I'm talking about us. We went to treatment. It was explained to us, and we accepted that we're alcoholics. And still, probably 80% die of alcoholism. How could you die when you know all about it? If someone told you you were allergic to mustard, you just wouldn't eat mustard. You know what I'm saying? You want mustard on your hot dog? No. Nope, that stuff, oh, I'm sick for a month and a half. No mustard. You wouldn't go to meetings of Mustard Anonymous and ask people, how the hell did you stay away from mustard? You just wouldn't eat the freaking mustard. You follow what I'm saying? So we come in here and we find out and we go, oh, my God, I'm an alcoholic. Holy jeez. And, you know, it crushed our ego, and we go, oh, boy, I'm an alcoholic. Well, I'm going to accept I'm an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. And you have the sense that having accepted the truth about yourself to the very core of your being would protect you from dying of alcoholism. But it doesn't. It's useless. Knowledge is of no use in protecting us against alcoholism. So why do alcoholics die of alcoholism? They die because they're under the impression that when the idea of taking cold beer hits their head, which it's going to, you're out on a hot day, you see a Budweiser truck go by, it's very normal. AA people all over the world go, wow, cold beer would be nice. But that's immediately followed with, but it would kill me. You follow what I'm saying? And so we may do that 9 times in a row. We see a drink and we go, oh, wouldn't that be nice? And then we go, no, that would kill me. But the 10th time, we go, Yeah, I think I'll have one. And you go, what'd you just say? I said, I think I'll have that beer. And the thought occurred to me. And our literature talks about it. There will come a day when the alcoholic has no defense against the first drink. And that's the defense we're talking about. The thought of a cold beer hits your head, and it isn't stamped out by the awareness of being an alcoholic. We're vulnerable. It's like Russian roulette. When am I going to have that thought and there's no defense? And it comes in and I take it, and then God knows what's going to happen. This protection has to come from a higher power. That's the entire point of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to give us the spiritual protection against that lapse, that split second when the idea of taking a drink pops into your head and you act on it. And we talk about it in the big book. We're not cured of alcoholism. We have a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. And so you can see that this thing is built so that we are going to get no stronger on our own, but we're going to establish such a close connection to this great spiritual resource that we have a bodyguard. We have 12 guys walking around with us. We have total protection against the first drink. I haven't thought of taking a drink in 45 years, 46 years. It never comes into my mind. And if you're new and you wonder what a miracle looks like, you hear about miracles in AA, I'll tell you a miracle. It may have already happened to you. If you had this conversation with one of your friends, a miracle has happened. And this is the conversation. You say to one of your friends, you know, I've been in AA about 3 months now. And last month, I forgot to think about drinking. You forgot to think about drinking, really? Yeah, the thought never entered my mind to have a drink. Really? How do you think that happened? What possible explanation for someone who obsessed about drinking for 35 years could explain why the thought of taking a drink didn't show up last month? If we don't see that as spiritual protection, we're seeing it wrong. If we're taking credit for that, what a horrible mistake. It's not us that's doing anything. We are receiving this gift. And so I didn't understand any of this. I had to shift from the language of the material world to the language of the AA spiritual world. I had to learn that problems don't get solved, they get removed. That I don't look up answers, I wait until they're revealed. I had to learn all these words that we see in our book are really true. And then I come to rely on that. I just go, God, I don't know what to do in this situation. I will stop working on it and go to the movies. That's my favorite advice to new people that I'm sponsoring when they have terrible problems. I said, what are you going to do about the problem? I'm going to go home and think about it. No, don't go. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. I want you to go to the movies. Let's look in the paper. Do you like that movie? Okay, go to that movie tonight. And when you get there, buy the ticket. Look at the ticket. See how long the movie is. 2 hours and 12 minutes. Go outside and say, God, I'm going to be in the movies for 2 hours and 12 minutes. Would you watch everything while I'm in there? Because I'm just going to watch the movie. And I say, do you think you can do that? Yeah, okay, all right, God, you watch it. And then they go in, they watch the movie. Then they come out, and they go, okay, God, no, I'm back, I'll take over. And once you get it back, you just go, man, this is pretty well straightened out. I don't see any big problem here. In other words, in order to turn it over, you have to let go of it. You can't go, would you help me work on this and it'll be a joint effort and the two of us will work on it, me and God. No, you let go of the damn thing. I'll work on it. I'll give it back to you later. And it's hard to believe that that could possibly work. I think our entire program can be summed up with let go and let God. Let go and let God. Let go. This is how we are when we come in. We have death grip on everything in our life. I'm watching all that, And when we work the first step, we let go of alcohol. So now it looks like this. And it feels like we did that. You follow what I'm saying? Yeah, I just let go. And they said, no, you. What about all this? What's that? Well, I just can't let go of everything. So do you realize how much effort is involved in prying one more finger loose? We have steps that go on and on. We have to inventory. We have to talk to a sponsor. We have to get to step six. We're entirely ready to loosen one finger. Are you sure you're going to just... I find it comical how stupid I am and how much resistance I offer to something I know that works perfectly. And that is that we are a human being and we're trying to incorporate spirituality into our lives, and it's a comedy show to watch it, to watch the resistance. Just imagine you're in step six and you're going to develop the willingness to have these character defects lifted out. The problem with this is God's going to get involved, and God's an extremist. He's not a half measure guy at all. In other words, when you became willing to get rid of your alcohol program, boom, gone. Alcohol doesn't even come up. It is gone. What if he did that to lust? Whoa, gone? Like all gone? Like, what are you, dead? What is? I'd like to get rid of most of it. That's what I'd like. I'd like to get, put me down 80% of lust. Get it the hell out of here. I want to get rid of that. Okay, so you're not willing to have lust entirely removed. Not yet. How about greed? Yeah, greed. Greedy people are greedy. You read about them in the paper. Look at those greedy guys. It was greedy. Well, would you like it entirely removed? Yeah, well, most of it. I'd like, I'm a businessman. And every so often, if you're going to stay in business, come on. So what do you want? Give me 80%. Give me 80% on greed. What about honesty? How about 100% honest? You'd just be going to be... Well, I'm also a businessman, and we... I'd like to be known as an honest businessman. I'd like to have the reputation of an honest businessman, but goddamn, I don't want to be locked into just telling my freaking clients the truth. People that read Chuck Chamberlain's book about how he did business, they just go, are you kidding? You can't do that. You know, and he's just getting more business than he could shake a stick at because he was so honest and did whatever the clients wanted, et cetera. So we see the fun that's involved in our own imperfection. We have to accept our imperfection. We embrace it, that it was put there. And this is our struggle. We get A pluses not because we can become perfect. We get A pluses because we're willing to try to go in that direction. I'm willing to raise my eyes, as Bill says in the sixth step in the 12 and 12, towards perfection, knowing I'll never get there. I'm just committed to see how close a contact I can establish. When we get to this stage in our sobriety, I'm going to wrap up in about 3 minutes, I promise, because I'm hungry too. Once you've moved along a certain amount in AA, it's really how much progress you now make is totally up to you. As an individual, you become the seeker. You decide What priority am I going to give in my life to moving up the spiritual ladder? I can stay here. I can be reasonably comfortable with pretty good sobriety for the rest of my life. And nobody's going to criticize you. But Bill, I like to quote Lincoln, that good is the biggest enemy of the best that there is. And so moving from this pretty good to a higher level has to be done voluntarily. In the seventh step again, in the 12 and 12, Bill writes, a great turning point in our lives came when we saw humility as something we wanted rather than something we had to have. We decided, I'm going to go through the pain of further growth. I'm making this decision. And so seeking, to me, becomes a very important word after we've moved to a certain level. And my little pitch about seeking is, I didn't know what the word meant when I first heard it. And I was in grammar school. And the teacher said, we're going to play hide and seek. And I went, well, what's that? Well, Mary's going to hide. We're going to cover our eyes. And then we're going to try and find her. Oh, great. Okay, go look. And I'm looking, looking. Well, if I didn't find her in 2 minutes, the hell would Mary? You know what I mean? I mean, how long am I supposed to look? Very low level of seeking. The next level I remember was the Easter basket. 5 pounds of solid chocolate. Now he got my attention. Hey, Mom, okay, they're hitting. Now we're ready to go. Okay, I'm looking in here. I'm looking in. Well, about 30 minutes. Mom, am I close? Am I warm? Even 5 pounds of chocolate, I finally went, the hell with the Easter bunny. I'm going to go play ball. That's it. When I was about 16, our golden retriever ran away. And I came home, and my father said, we don't know what happened. He went off in those woods. And I called him. I stayed out there every night when I come home from school. Then when I went away to college, a year later, every time I came home, guess where I was? I was over by the woods calling his name. That's a high level of seeking. I kept it up for years. I'd come home after 10 years, and I'd go, well, I'll just drive by there. I know it's a long shot, but he might be there. So could I ever get the level of my seeking up to where it was after that dog? And that's a good question to ask ourselves. What's available here is available to everyone. And we're the ones that choose it. And I just hope that someone tonight takes the level of seeking up another notch. And I hope if you're new, that you realize the people in this room can offer you a life beyond your wildest dreams. All you have to do is let go and follow what they tell you. Thank you all very much.
Ooh, we made it. What up?
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.